This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to Military Times. My name is Mark Love, and our first article comes from page of Military Times magazine, dated March 12, 2025. Judge hopes to rule next week on Trump order banning trans troops. A federal judge said Wednesday that she hopes to rule next week on whether to block President Donald Trump's administration from banning transgender people from serving in the U.S. military. At the end of a day-long hearing in Washington, D.C., U.S. District Judge Anna Reyes said it's her strong hope that she will issue a decision next Tuesday or Wednesday. Reyes acknowledged that her ruling probably won't be the last stop in this train's journey, given the near certainty of an appeal. "I just have to do the best I can with the evidence in front of me," she said. Reyes spent most of Wednesday's hearing peppering a government attorney with questions about a new Defense Department policy that presumptively disqualifies people with gender dysphoria from military service. Gender dysphoria is a distress that a person feels because their assigned gender and gender identity don't match. The medical condition has been linked to depression and suicidal thoughts. The new policy stems from a January 27th executive order by President Donald Trump that claims the sexual identity of a transgender service member conflicts with a soldier's commitment to an honorable, truthful, and disciplined lifestyle, even in one's personal life. Roughly 2,000 transgender people serve in the military, but they represent less than 1% of the total number of active duty service members. Reyes frequently sounded skeptical of the administration's motives and rationale as she challenged Justice Department Attorney Jason Mannion to defend the order and policy. She called it a "don't tell" policy, a reference to the military's outdated "don't ask, don't tell" policy against LGBTQ service members. "They have to essentially be in hiding while in service," Reyes said of a transgender troops. The judge said the Defense Department has spent roughly $5.2 million annually over the past decade to prove medical care to treat gender dysphoria, a minuscule percentage of the military's multi-million-dollar budget. As a point of comparison, Reyes noted that the military spends around $42 million per year on medication treating erectile dysfunction. "It's not even a rounding error, right?" she asked. "If it's a cost per service member, it does matter," Mannion said. The plaintiffs who sued to block Trump's order include an Army Reserves platoon leader from Pennsylvania, an Army major who was awarded a Bronze Star for service in Afghanistan, and a Sailor of the Year award winner serving in the Navy. Their attorneys contend that Trump's order violates transgender people's rights to equal protection under the Fifth Amendment. Government lawyers argue that military officials have broad discretion to decide how to assign and deploy service members without judicial interference. And in our next article, U.S. veterans, military contractors among those freed from Kuwait jail, dated March 12, 2025. Kuwait has released a group of American prisoners, including veterans and military contractors jailed for years on drug-related charges, in a move seen as a gesture of goodwill between two allies, a representative for the detainees told the Associated Press on Wednesday. The release follows a recent visit to the region by Adam Boehler, the Trump administration's top hostage envoy, and comes amid a continued U.S. government push to bring home American citizens jailed in foreign countries. Six of the newly freed prisoners were accompanied on a flight from Kuwait to New York by Jonathan Franks, a private consultant who works on cases involving American hostages and detainees and who had been in the country to help secure their release. "My clients and their families are grateful to the Kuwaiti government for this kind of humanitarian gesture," Franks said in a statement. He said that his clients maintain their innocence and that additional Americans he represents also are expected to be released by Kuwait later. The State Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The names of the released prisoners were not immediately made public. Kuwait, a small oil-rich nation that borders Iraq and Saudi Arabia, is near Iran and is considered a major non-NATO ally of the United States. Secretary of State Marco Rubio paid tribute paid tribute to that relationship as recently as last month, when he said the U.S. remains steadfast in its support for Kuwait's sovereignty and the well-being of its people. The countries have been close military partnerships since America launched in 1991 Gulf War to expel Iraqi troops after Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein invaded the country, with some 13,500 American troops stationed in Kuwait at Camp Arafan and Ali al-Salem Air Base. But Kuwait has also detained many American military contractors on drug charges, in some cases for years. Their families have alleged that their loved ones faced abuse while imprisoned in a country that bans alcohol and has strict laws regarding drugs. Others have criticized Kuwaiti police for bringing trumped-up charges and manufacturing evidence used against them, allegations never acknowledged by the autocratic nation ruled by a hereditary emir. The State Department warns travelers that drug charges in Kuwait can carry long prison sentences and the death penalty. Defense cooperation agreements between the U.S. and Kuwait likely include provisions that ensure U.S. troops are subject only to American laws, though that likely doesn't include contractors. Since President Donald Trump returned to the White House, his Republican administration has secured the release of American school teacher Mark Fogel and a prison swap with Russia, and has announced the release by Belarus of an imprisoned U.S. citizen. The American police Wednesday had not been designated by the U.S. government as wrongfully detained. The status is applied to a subsection of Americans jailed abroad and historically ensures the case is handled by the administration's Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, the office that handles negotiations for a release. But advocates of those held in foreign countries are hopeful the Trump administration takes a more flexible approach and secures the release of those not deemed wrongfully detained. The sad reality is that these Americans were left in prison for years due to a misguided policy that had, before President Trump took office, effectively abandoned Americans abroad who hadn't been designated wrongfully detained, Frank said in a statement. These releases, he added, demonstrate what is achievable when the U.S. government prioritizes bringing Americans home. And in our next article, U.S. arms flow to Ukraine again as the Kremlin mulls ceasefire proposal, dated May 12, 2025. From Kyiv, Ukraine. U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine resumed Wednesday, after officials said, a day after the Trump administration lifted its suspension of military aid for Kyiv in its fight against Russian invasion, and officials awaited the Kremlin's response to a proposed 30-day ceasefire endorsed by Ukraine. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said it's important not to get ahead of the question of responding to the ceasefire, which was proposed by Washington. He told reporters that Moscow is awaiting detailed information from the U.S. and suggested that Russia must get there before it can take a position. The Kremlin has previously opposed anything short of a permanent end to the conflict and has not accepted any concessions. U.S. President Donald Trump wants to end the three-year war and pressured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to enter talks. The suspension of U.S. assistance happened days after Zelensky and Trump argued about the conflict in a tense White House meeting. The administration's decision to resume military aid after talks Tuesday with senior Ukrainian officials in Saudi Arabia marked a sharp shift in its stance. Trump said it's up to Russia now, as his administration presses Moscow to agree to the ceasefire. And hopefully we can get a ceasefire from Russia, Trump said Wednesday in an extended exchange with reporters during the Oval Office meeting with Michael Martin, the Prime Minister of Ireland. And if we do, I think we would be 80% of the way to getting this horrible bloodbath ended. The U.S. president again made veiled threats of hitting Russia with new sanctions. We can, but I hope it's not going to be necessary, Trump said. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who led the American delegation to Saudi Arabia, where Ukraine consented to the U.S. ceasefire proposal, said Washington will pursue multiple points of contact with Russia to see if President Vladimir Putin is ready to negotiate an end to the war. He declined to give details or say what steps might be taken if Putin refuses to engage. The U.S. hopes to see Russia stop attacks on Ukraine within the next few days. As a first step, Rubio said at a refueling stop Wednesday in Shannon, Ireland, on his way to talks in Canada with other groups of seven leading industrialized nations. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told Fox News that National Security Advisor Mike Waltz spoke Wednesday with his Russian counterpart. He also confirmed that Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, will head to Moscow for talks with Russian officials. She did not say with whom Witkoff planned to meet. A person familiar with the matter said Witkoff expected to meet with Putin later this week. The person was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on a condition of anonymity. Ukraine says ceasefire would allow time for planning to end the war. Zelensky said the 30-day ceasefire would allow the sides to fully prepare a step-by-step plan for ending the war, including security guarantees for Ukraine. Technical questions over how to effectively monitor a truce along the roughly 600-mile front line, where small but deadly drones are common, are very important, Zelensky told reporters Wednesday in Kyiv. Arms deliveries to Ukraine have already resumed through a Polish logistics center, the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Poland announced Wednesday. Deliveries go through a NATO and U.S. hub in eastern Polish city of Rzeszów that has been used to ferry Western weapons into neighboring Ukraine about 45 miles away. The American military help is vital for Ukraine's shorthanded and worrying army, which is having a tough time keeping Russia's bigger military force at bay. For Russia, the American aid spells potentially more difficulty in achieving war aims, and it could make Washington's peace efforts a tougher sell in Moscow. The U.S. government has also restored Ukraine's access to unclassified commercial satellite pictures provided by Maxar Technologies through a program Washington runs. Maxar spokesperson Tommy Maxt told the Associated Press, "The images help Ukraine plan attacks, assess their success, and monitor Russian movements." In other developments, officials acknowledged Wednesday that Kyiv no longer has access to any long-range Army tactical missile system or ATACMS missiles. According to a U.S. official and a Ukrainian lawmaker on the country's defense committee, Ukraine has run out of ATACMS. The official spoke on a condition of anonymity to provide military weapons details. The U.S. officials said that the U.S. provided fewer than 40 of those missiles overall and that Ukraine ran out of them in late January. Senior U.S. defense leaders, including the previous Pentagon chief Lloyd Austin, had made it clear that only a limited number of ATACMS would be delivered and that the U.S. and NATO allies considered other weapons to be more valuable in the fight. Russia steps up efforts to regain control of Kursk region. The developments came amid intensifying Russian efforts to push Ukrainian forces out of the Kremlin's Kursk region that have yielded breakthroughs in recent days, Ukrainian soldiers told AP. The fighting has escalated as ceasefire talks come to a head, with Moscow intent on taking back its territory and Kyiv determined to hold on to it as a bargaining chip in any negotiations. Ukrainian forces made a daring raid into Russian region last August in the first foreign occupation of Russian territory since World War II. They have held on despite intense pressure from tens of thousands of Russians and North Korean troops. Recent fighting reportedly has focused on the Kursk town of Sutska, which is a key Ukrainian supply hub and operational base. Ukrainian soldiers said the situation is dynamic and fighting continues in and around the town, but three of them conceded Russian forces were making headway. Russian state news agencies RIA, Novosti, and TASS reported Wednesday that the Russian military has entered Sutska. It was not possible to independently verify either side's claims. Inside Ukraine, Russian ballistic missiles killed at least five civilians, officials said Wednesday. Russian officials are worried about the U.S.-Ukraine talks. Russian lawmakers signal wariness about the prospect of a ceasefire. Russia is advancing on the battlefield, so it will be different with Russia, senior Russian Senator Konstantin Kosachev noted in a post on the messaging app Telegram. Any agreements with the understanding of the need for compromise should be on our terms, not American, Kosachev wrote. Lawmaker Mikhail Sheremet told the state news agency TASS that Russia is not interested in continuing the war, but at the same time, Moscow will not tolerate being strung along. The outcome of the Saudi Arabia talks placed the onus on Washington to persuade Moscow to accept and implement a ceasefire, said John Hardy, a defense analyst and deputy director of the Russia program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a Washington-based research institute. Moscow will present itself as cooperative, but may push for agreement on basic principles for a final peace deal before agreeing on a ceasefire, he said. Russia may also insist on barring Western military aid to Ukraine during the ceasefire and on Ukraine holding elections ahead of a long-term peace agreement. Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, known as SVR, reported Wednesday that the service chief, Sergei Nurkin, spoke on a phone Tuesday with CIA Director John Ratcliffe. The two discussed cooperation in areas of common interest and a resolution of crisis situations, according to a statement by the SVR. And in our next article, 3D printing barracks, military eyes, new ways to cut construction costs, dated March 12, 2025. The Army and Navy may soon use alternative methods for building barracks, including 3D printing, in an effort to reduce the financial burden, according to a Defense Department release. Top engineers for respective services met with lawmakers on Capitol Hill on Tuesday to discuss the potential use of 3D printing and mass timber construction as a means of maximizing cost efficiency. Dave Morrill, Director of the Military Programs for Army Corps of Engineers, and Keith Hamilton, Chief Engineer for Naval Facilities Engineering Systems Command, spoke with members of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. The group also discussed the use of high-performance cement, geosynthetics, composite materials, tension fabric structures, and carbon fiber-reinforced polymers, according to the release. An increasingly complex global security environment, our commitment to innovation in military construction is not just about building structures. It's about building the resilience and readiness our forces need to prevail, Morrow said. He emphasized the importance of using cost-cutting-edge construction methods to discover to deliver sustainable and cost-effective infrastructure to provide service members with high-end facilities. Morrow said the technologies they seek to implement have already been put to use in several military installations. Tyndall Air Force Base, Florida, and Fort Bliss, Texas, have already both used 3D printing, he pointed out, the latter specifically for projects involving bearings. The Navy has already employed the use of mass timber, Hamilton said, to build a child development center in Hampton Roads, Virginia. The practice of mass timber construction involves sourcing structural beams that come from smaller lumber. The first Army barracks made using mass timber structural elements was recently completed, according to Hamilton, with another potential mass timber project on the horizon at Mountain Home Air Force Base. Hamilton also cited the use of high-performance concrete to build an F-35 Lightning II hangar at Marine Air Corps Air Station, Cherry Point, North Carolina, as a viable method for future construction. And in our next article, Marine Corps will receive first anti-ship missile battery in Okinawa, dated March 12, 2025. The 12th Marine Littoral Regiment welcomed a new unit that will soon wield the service's first anti-ship missile defense system in Okinawa, Japan, according to a spokesperson for Marine Corps Combat Development and Integration. The 12th Littoral Combat Team was officially established at Camp Hansen in Okinawa on March 3rd to create chaos and uncertainty in potential adversaries, according to a Marine Corps release. The addition of the team to the Littoral Regiment marks the third and final subordinate element of the regiment, which also includes the 12th Littoral Anti-Air Battalion and 12th Littoral Logistics Battalion. The team will focus on taking advantage of enemy's weaknesses while obfuscating their abilities to accurately locate American military personnel and disrupting their decision-making, the release stated. The Marine Corps Force Modernization Efforts design the LCT for speed, mobility, lethality, and precision. Lieutenant Colonel Jacob Godby, commanding officer of the 12th Littoral Combat Team, said in the release, "We work in combination with our adjacent commands in the 12th MLR and distributed operations to form relevant and ready combat formation in contested maritime environments. Starting in fiscal year 2026, the team will be equipped with the Navy and Marine Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System, or the Nemesis, a mobile ground-based carrier capable of firing anti-ship missiles," said a spokesperson for Marine Corps Systems Command. The Marine Corps redesigned the 3rd Marine Regiment to the 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment in March 2022 and converted the 12th Marine Regiment, which was already based in Okinawa, Japan, to the 12th Marine Littoral Regiment in November 2023. Military Times reported in January 2024 that the regiments would be equipped with capabilities designed to combat adversaries like the Chinese military, along with the Nemesis system, to The regiment will be expected to wield an MQ-9 Reaper unmanned aerial system, the ANTPS-80 ground and air task-oriented radar system, and the light amphibious warship. The regiments are slated to contain up to 2,000 Marines and sailors and are expected to carry out deployments to choke points along islands and coastlines. The formation didn't just stand up, it surged forward. Colonel Peter Owingham, commanding officer of the 12th Marine Littoral Regiment, said in a release, "We bring this combat power to Okinawa to be able to deliver it in the eyes of our adversaries and ensure we can bring it to the decisive point on the battlefield." And in our next article, military medical system unprepared for future conflicts, experts say, dated March 11th, 2025. When it comes to combat casualty care, without urgent intervention, the military health system will continue to slide into medical obsolescence, a retired Air Force trauma surgeon told senators Tuesday. The consequences of a military medical system that's unprepared to handle a high volume of casualties in any future major conflict is that many will have survivable injuries, yet one in four will die at the hands of an unprepared system, said Dr. Jeremy W. Cannon, a professor of surgery at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and a surgeon in Philadelphia Veterans Affairs Medical Center. Only about 10% of military general surgeons experience the patient volume level of acute cases and variety of cases needed to remain designated as combat ready. According to Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, the percentage of military general surgeons meeting the necessary readiness standards dropped from 17% in 2015 to 10% in 2019. We're actively falling into the trap of the peacetime effect, Cannon, a retired Air Force colonel, told members of the Senate Armed Services Committee. That 10% is caused by grossly inadequate patient volume, Cannon said. They're not doing the cases, not doing the procedures. They're not doing what they were trained to do. That's because they don't have the patients in the facilities. He and two other military retirees who rose to high-ranking positions in the military medical establishment testified Tuesday about ways to prepare the military's surge capability, including the need to invest in level one trauma centers for military medical facilities. We've de-scoped our facilities to the point where they take care of low acuity community hospital patients, not trauma patients, said retired Air Force Major General Paul A. Fredericks, the former Joint Staff Surgeon. We need our key hospitals to be level one trauma centers in partnership with the American Colleges of Surgeons in the communities where they are located. To do so, they must be adequately funding, he said. There's no way to fix the problems without adequate funding, the witnesses said. It's a mistake to think military medical care could be provided at a lower cost than in the civilian sector and still be ready for conflict, Fredericks added. Costs of medical care nationwide have risen about 5.1% per year on average since 1938, Fredericks said. But since 2015, the budget for military hospitals has decreased by nearly 12%, according to Wicker, the committee chair. The military medical system has been working to attract patients back to military treatment facilities after forcing many military beneficiaries to seek care in the private sector. We need our military medics taking care of sick patients, Frederick said. There's a comparison, for example, between taking care of a bladder cancer patient who needs to have their bladder removed and someone with a gunshot wound in the abdomen who needs to have a bladder reconstructed, he explained. Meanwhile, military facilities must be fully staffed, said retired Air Force Lieutenant General Douglas J.F., who served as the first director of the Defense Health Agency. That includes the full spectrum of support for critical care hospitals. Rob suggested the military also work more with Veterans Affairs and civilian military facilities so military surgeons could work more cases that would bolster their combat readiness. Instead of duplicating efforts, the military health system needs to work with Veterans Affairs facilities, said Fredericks, who commanded a DOD-VA joint venture in Anchorage, Alaska. There, he said, patients were taken care of by a joint team. It was far more efficient than building the duplicative adjacent facilities. Instead, we built integrated adjacent facilities. Fredericks noted that there is $10 billion of unfunded facility needs in DOD and $100 billion in VA. There are opportunities to bring patients with acute care needs from the VA into DOD facilities. So bring DOD military medical personnel into a VA medical facilities, he said, so that we are not wasting money on duplicative buildings and instead focusing our resources on the patients who need our care. It's critical, Fredericks added, that medics are clearly defined as being part of the joint military. As long as we preserve this false narrative that the military health system is separate and not covered by the same expectation of jointness as the rest of the military, we're going to continue to have these fruitless bureaucratic buffoonery actions that distract us from taking care of patients, he said. A root problem, Cannon said, is that no one within DOD truly owns combat casualty care. He recommended that Congress establish clear leadership on that front. Wicker acknowledged the importance of there being enough combat-ready surgeons. We know that troops in combat are more comfortable taking the risk necessary to accomplish their mission if they have confidence in their military doctors. In our next article, key defense policy voice for Senate Democrats won't seek re-election, dated March 12, 2025. New Hampshire Senator Jeanine Shaheen, the second-ranking Democrat on the Chamber's Armed Services Committee, announced Wednesday she will not seek re-election in 2026. The 78-year-old former New Hampshire governor has been a prominent national security and military policy voice for Senate Democrats for more than a decade. In addition to her 14 years on the Armed Services panel, Shaheen was the first woman ever to serve as the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In a statement, Shaheen said she planned to serve out the remainder of her current term. There are urgent challenges ahead, but here at home and around the world, she said, and while I'm not seeking re-election, believe me, I am not retiring. I am determined to work every day over the next 2 years and beyond to continue to try and make a difference for the people of New Hampshire and this country. Shaheen has been a vocal supporter of U.S. assistance to Ukraine and restarted a bipartisan Senate NATO Observer Group in 2018 to help strengthen the U.S. support for that alliance. She has also been a driving force in efforts to expand the Afghan Special Immigrant Visa Program to help former foreign nationals who assisted with U.S. war efforts in Afghanistan relocate to safer areas. Shaheen has served as co-chair of the Senate's bipartisan National Guard Caucus, pushing for friendlier personnel policies and increased investment in the force. And she has been a longtime advocate for Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and further investment in New England shipbuilding force. Fellow Senate Armed Services Committee Democrat Gary Peters of Michigan announced last month that he also will not seek re-election next year. Both states are expected to be key battlegrounds for control for the Senate in 2027. Republicans currently hold a 53-47 majority in the chamber, with two independent senators caucusing with the Democrats. Well, I'm afraid this is all the time we have for now. I'd like to thank you for listening to Military Times. My name is Mark Love, and I hope that you'll join us next.